Welcome to the Valor Podcast. It's a really great pleasure to have Jameson Lopp with us today. Jameson, as many of you know, has been in the Bitcoin space for a long, long time, over a decade, I believe. We'll talk a little bit about his history there. He's a Bitcoin pioneer, a self-proclaimed cypherpunk, co-founder of Casa, which we'll no doubt speak quite a lot about, where he's also the chief security officer. One of the reasons I was very excited about getting Jameson on the podcast is that he's really one of the most prominent figures in the crypto space, in the Bitcoin space, about security, privacy, self-custody, all very, very important topics, which I would love our 1.4 million customers around the world, Jameson, to really gain from your knowledge and your best practices. Obviously, we're a centralized exchange, but we often talk to people about the need to think about your own security setup. And we obviously advocate doing self-custody when you know what you're doing, but we'll talk about that a bit more. Jameson's a computer science. He has a computer science degree. He's worked at BitGo, also one of the, I would say, OG companies in the Bitcoin space. He created Satoshi, a fork of the Bitcoin Core node a fork of Bitcoin Core for node analytics. And also he's got a great resources at lopp.net. I really encourage everybody to go to lopp.net. There's a lot of information that's great over there. But the one place I'd like to start off, Jameson, is 2017, where obviously you had a swatting incident, which I'd like you to just tell us a little bit about. But that really kind of, I think, was a turning point for you in many ways. So let's just start off with what exactly happened in 2017. And then the question I'll ask after that is kind of, how did that change things for you?
Yeah, so essentially 2017 was the height of the Bitcoin block size wars, the scaling debates, and tensions were high. A lot of people were getting very upset as arguments were occurring on different forums and social media. And I ended up saying something at some point that upset the wrong person, and they basically reached out to someone that they knew who had expertise with swatting people and said, hey, we should screw with this guy. He's an OG Bitcoiner. You can probably extort him. It'll be worth your while, so on and so forth. And I ended up having several dozen heavily armed law enforcement officers shut down my entire suburban neighborhood of 400 homes because they had received a call that was claiming it was me at my house, claiming that I had killed people and had people hostage and had bombs, and basically using all of the trigger words that are necessary to get a massive lethal response from law enforcement to come out, because they're pretty much obligated to investigate these types of claims. And thankfully, the incident itself ended without anybody being hurt. There have been swattings where people have been shot and killed by law enforcement. And it was kind of a close call for me because I had actually been to the shooting range the day before, and I had a bunch of firearms laying out in my living room waiting to be cleaned. But I had a few things going for me, one of which was that I was already somewhat practicing decent operational security. And the tweet that I had made that morning, which I believe led the swatter to believe that I was at home and would be a good target, I actually made that when I was not at home. I was at the gym already going about my usual business. And so I ended up coming back home from the gym and running into the law enforcement blockade there. So thankfully, it wasn't an incident of me just minding my own business, sitting at home and having law enforcement bust in and potentially something terrible happening. We were able to figure out what was going on fairly quickly, and the situation got resolved. But that kicked off a multi-year journey of me trying to understand what I would need to do to prevent that from ever happening again. And then once I had sufficiently hardened my privacy, my operational security, that kicked off a multi-year investigation of me hunting down the guy who attacked me. I think that took 4 years, basically. But I did end up getting some justice there. It was a kind of bittersweet thing because it was just some naive young kid living in his mother's basement. He fell in with the wrong crowd. He didn't really understand the ramifications of what he was doing, but I think he learned his lesson, and I learned a lot, and now I speak a lot about the the ramifications of being a public person in this space where people are kind of doing calculations in the back of their head of like, okay, this person's been into Bitcoin for this many years and they are probably a soft target and we could try to extort them. We could try to hack them. We could try to wrench attack them. And what, as a result, do people in this space who have essentially outed themselves as investors need to do if they want to be sufficiently safe from all of these types of attacks. So, security is a never-ending cat and mouse game. So it's a good business to be in for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you for sharing. We met recently in New York. And one of the things I came up to you and I was just actually asking you about some of your security views, etc. One of the things that you said struck me, which is you said, I sleep well at night. So I really wanted to kind of put ourselves in the kind of the shoes of our viewers. So these are people that are very sophisticated when it comes to crypto and security, and all the way down to people that are just beginners and just understanding what Bitcoin is, not even necessarily even understanding what a Bitcoin private key is, etc. So one of my goals of this podcast is that for our user base to listen to it and to gain some insights about their own personal security. So I think when you said I sleep well at night, I think I'd like you just to kind of put your views, your shoes in yourself in the shoes of kind of this beginners and the most, sophisticated people. How do you make that happen, given the wide range of experience that people have? And what is like the main mistake that people are making when it comes to the custody of their Bitcoin? So really just a foray into kind of what's your advice into how to get this personal setup right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few components to that. One is the actual architecture of how your keys and your assets are secured. So I sleep well at night because I don't keep my assets with trusted third parties. So I don't have to worry about getting rug pulled or having my accounts get arbitrarily shut down for some unknown reason that won't be disclosed due to Bank Secrecy Act regulations, or really just internal issues that can happen. Some companies, well, really any company can have bad actors inside of them, and you can't necessarily know what the internal policies and practices are of any given company. So third-party custody is always going to be a black box from the outsider's perspective. So if you want to actually understand what the security model for your crypto assets is, you have to be doing it yourself. Like, you have to set it up yourself. You have to manage it yourself. You don't have to do everything yourself. Obviously, this is why Casa exists. We essentially help people help themselves. But I sleep well at night because I don't have single points of failure in my actual asset custody. So A, that's because I'm not keeping them with a trusted third party. B, it's because I'm not just keeping them, one key in one location. I have multiple redundancies and a geographic distribution of keys. If my house burns down, it's not going to be a catastrophic loss for my assets. I'm confident that I've thought through basically every possible scenario of attack and loss for my assets, and that they can withstand pretty much anything that wouldn't be a sort of world apocalyptic event, in which case we got bigger issues to deal with. Now, the other side of this, which is a separate problem, is like the actual physical security of myself, my body, and so forth, right? So, even if your assets are sufficiently distributed and robust against any type of attack or loss, if it's really easy for people to find you, you can still end up having problems. And this is where some of the Wrench attack situations come into play. We can learn a lot from them because we are aware of like 240 at this point, though there have definitely been way more than that. I would say anywhere between 4 and 10 times as many Wrench attacks out there as the ones that we're actually aware of. And that's a whole other problem, like I said.
When you say Wrench attack, why don't you just explain to our viewers what does that term mean?
Essentially, it means physical robbery. It means, someone coming to you and placing you under duress and coercing you into handing over your money. And we're kind of in the discovery phase right now where Wrench attacks are relatively rare compared to the many other forms of theft and attack and loss that can happen in this space, but they are going up and they are roughly correlated with the exchange rate. This makes sense because if you think about it, the vast majority of people are generally quote unquote good people, right? They don't want to hurt other people for their own personal gain, but there's always going to be some like single digit percentage of the population that's, psychopath or sociopath. And they're just trying to figure out, what's the best return on my investment. And so right now we're in this discovery phase where people who are willing to hurt others for their own gain are finding out that, why would I go try to rob a bank or an armored truck or, some retail business where either like the risk is really high or the reward is really low, even if the risk is lower? And unfortunately, with these digital bearer assets that are generally being held and accessed by one single person with one, single authorization, that's a fairly low risk and fairly high reward outcome. And so, the criminals are basically probing this sector right now. And unfortunately, they're pretty successful. Like the majority of these Wrench attacks that we're aware of that are happening are successful. And the perpetrators, when they're successful, they tend to get away with quite a bit, like usually at least in the six figures, sometimes seven, sometimes even eight figures from their targets. So this is just another reason why CASA exists, why I'm constantly preaching having better security, because this is a problem for all of us. Even if you think, I'm not going to get Wrench attacked, every time someone in the space is successfully Wrench attacked and an attacker is essentially rewarded for that attack, then this is information, this is signal that we are sending out to the entire world that says, hey, this is a profitable endeavor, and it's incentivizing more and more of them to happen. So until we get to the point where the average holder is sufficiently safe and guarded against this because they're following best practices and we get the success rate of these attacks to drop, then I think that it's only logical that we should assume that the number of attacks is going to continue to increase as long as the attackers themselves are being enriched.
Do you have any stats on actually what percentage have been successful of those 240 odd ones that you just mentioned?
I actually just gave a presentation in Vegas, but it was around like 60% of the attacks that were successful. And then I also have stats around, number of attacks per year, which roughly follows like the price charts and, the amount of money that is being taken by these attackers, though the further you drill down into these data sets, the less accurate the data is, because, for example, first of all, we probably only have like 10 to 30% of the attacks that get reported, and then only a subset of those will reveal other attributes like the amount that was stolen. So it could vary. I think in recent years I was seeing over $30 million a year that was being taken by wrench attacks. And so, and that's just the tiny subset that we can calculate. So it's, you know, it's probably well over $100 million a year.
And for those that don't know, in the last few weeks, we've seen some that have been reported in New York, in France, in Canada. So this is something that has happened in France for some reason multiple times.
That was actually, they believe it was one mastermind, this like Moroccan French guy, who they did arrest, I think, last week. So hopefully that'll stop the slew of French kidnappings for a little while. And, you know, despite that slew that happened this year, from a per capita risk standpoint, France is actually not in even like the top 10 countries. It's still relatively safe in terms of wrench attacks. Actually, the country that is the riskiest per capita is UAE. And that's because there have been 9 known attacks, and I think all of them were basically OTC trades. So, you know, somebody saying, hey, I want to buy or sell
physical OTC trades.
Yeah, that's one of the riskiest things you can do is face-to-face OTC trades. Basically, someone they'll even start off with tiny buys and then ramp it up and get to the, like, I want to do 500,000 or I want to do $1 million trade. And they'll basically say, you know, meet me in this hotel room. You go to the hotel, they jump you, they take everything that you have. To Dubai's credit, they also have the highest justice rate in the sense that 100% of those attackers were very quickly apprehended and did not get to take advantage of their success. I think that that's because my understanding is, you know, Dubai is very heavily surveilled and it's very easy for them to track people down.
Yep. Okay. So obviously very serious issue. What is your response to, you know, what I say to customers is I said, you know, it really depends on people's knowledge of their setup. So, you know, where people, you know, a lot of people are used to going and resetting their password, right? If they have lost access to something. And obviously with Bitcoin, if you lose your private key, your seed phrase, you cannot go and reset it. It's lost for good. So my personal advice to people is to say, we very much encourage people to self-custody if they know what they're doing. But what I also always say is that there are risks with every single thing that you do, right? So there is no such thing as a particular security approach that is riskless or risk-free. Everything comes with this risk. So I say, A, if you know what you're doing, by all means, go and do it. If you don't know what you're doing, then try to find a trusted custodian where you believe your assets will be safe. Obviously, Valor is a centralized exchange. We custody our customers' assets. We have a whole bunch of security measures that we take. As you said, there isn't any individual that can go and take the assets unilaterally. To your point, geographically distributed, multi-signature, etc. So, but that's very different where we're an institution where we invest in this. We have a dedicated cybersecurity team. So would you advocate to some, like maybe your response is no, just go get Casa, regardless of whatever level you are, come to Casa, which is a perfectly valid response. But for someone that's new, what would you say to them?
No, I think there's a number of different tiers of security, right? So security should always be commensurate with the amount of value of whatever it is that you're protecting. And that's just like a very broad generalization. You don't need to have a Fort Knox to secure amount of money that you would carry around cash in your wallet. These are very different paradigms of what you need to, like the threats that you need to be worried about. And so I generally classify it as, okay, if you only have like spending money, like the amount you would carry around cash in your wallet, and it that's inconsequential, if that gets lost or stolen, then fine, leave that with a trusted third party. Or if you want, you can use just a hot wallet on your phone. You don't need a super high level of security because the ramifications are not terrible if something goes wrong. But if you get to the point where you have more than that, you know, a non-trivial amount invested, you know, say $1,000 or more, it starts to make sense to invest in a hardware device. You know, you can get these hardware devices for like $50 to $100. There are a few that are more premium than that. But, you know, think of it as you're basically buying insurance. You know, whatever security you're setting up, you're basically paying for insurance ahead of time, because you generally in this space, there is no insurance to cover you after something goes terrible. There are a few products that are starting to come out around that, but it's still very early days. And so, you know, investing $50 or $100 in a hardware device protects you from 90 to 95% of the attack vectors that are all, you know, internet based. Basically, you're taking your keys off the internet. You no longer have this door open where 8 billion people can be knocking on it and trying to get through it and try to get to your key material and, you know, compromising whatever device it is that you have your money on. So that's really like one of the most effective low cost ways to protect yourself. But, you know, that doesn't protect you from everything. There's, you keep going further and further down the security rabbit hole, and you end up having to spend more and more time guarding against more and more edge case risks. But once again, what you're guarding against is catastrophic failure. So if you move beyond that, if you move to having a significant portion of your portfolio, your net worth in digital assets, that's when you need to start thinking about eliminating single points of failure. And so that's when, you know, you want to have multiple redundant geographically distributed backups of your seed phrases. You may want to think about using multisig itself, because, you know, even, for example, if you're using like a Trezor, Ledger, Cold Card, whatever, that's still a single point of failure. There's a single seed phrase that you have backed up, most likely in clear text. And if an attacker got a hold of that backup, they would be able to reconstitute your wallet and spend everything. So in order to protect against stuff like that, you want to have multisig, which basically means you're constructing this digital lockbox that requires multiple keys to cryptographically sign a transaction before the network will accept it. And that's what Casa helps people do. There's a number of, you know, free open source software solutions out there where you can do this yourself. But once again, this is all about like how much time are you putting into understanding all of the threats and being able to guard against them. And I would say, like, for most people, especially people who have a lot of wealth in the system, it's more effective for you to pay Casa as a security consulting service, because this is what we live and eat and breathe. And we will keep you apprised of any changes, you know, in the best practices, this dynamic security environment. And so really what we do is we help get people to a level where we assume that any part of your setup can and will fail over a long enough period of time. You know, people are human. People make mistakes. Natural disasters happen. And we have a really long list of threats that we have incorporated into our own security model and explain like how our architecture guards against them. But the short version is that anything can go wrong and you can still recover your money. And that includes Casa. Like, our company is not a single point of failure. We only hold one out of three or one out of five keys. So even if we disappeared, we can't prevent anyone from moving their funds. We can't spend funds without authorization from the user. We're really facilitating, you know, a more robust setup. But, It also gets even further down the rabbit hole into stuff like inheritance and, you know, multi-generational family planning. That's a really weird tightrope to walk. If you want to be in a setup where only you control your keys, but then magically a button kind of gets pressed if you die. And of course, the blockchain doesn't know if you're alive or dead. So, like, we have to construct other game theory and distribute keys in such a way that will allow your beneficiaries to be able to recover your funds. But if they try to do that while you're still alive, you can kick them out.
Sure, sure. So a couple of questions on what you said. So you talked about hardware wallets. Are there any particular ones that you've looked into that you think are worth people looking at that you can kind of not vouch for, but kind of recommend more than others?
Yeah, so there's many different attributes going on here. The short version is there is no perfect hardware wallet. They all have pros, cons, strengths, weaknesses. If you're buying one hardware wallet for a single signature wallet, then you definitely want one with a screen. This is like one of the major important points of a hardware device is it's basically a self-contained offline computer that allows you to verify the details of the transaction that you're signing so that you're not having to, you know, trust that some other wallet software running, you know, maybe on a phone or a desktop or whatever hasn't been compromised and is basically lying to you. You know, that's kind of what happened, like with the Bybit hack last year, for example, is basically the wallet software got compromised and they were not able to actually validate the transaction details, and they signed a transaction and it went somewhere that they didn't think it was going to be going, which was to the attackers rather than to their own wallet. So, you know, we support Trezor, Ledger, Coldcard, Foundation, Passport. The Bitbox is also good, and I'm sure there's more out there. I mean, there's a ton out there, but one of the other things that people should generally keep in mind is there's the saying in this space, vires in numeris, which is strength in numbers. And a lot of people only ascribe that to like the cryptography that secures these networks. And that is true. That's like one aspect of strength in numbers. But this also applies to just security in general, that whenever you're doing something that kind of strays outside of the like popular modus operandi of other people in the space, you're basically becoming an explorer. And, you know, exploration always has risks because there's just a lot more unknowns whenever you're exploring a space. It doesn't have to be a physical space. It can be this logical space, some new construction of some security architecture that just nobody else has ever used, hasn't been sufficiently vetted, and may have points of failure, foot guns, so on and so forth. So, you need to be careful and not try to get cute, not try to get too smart. Like, I've seen a lot of people try to be smart and do things like split up their seed phrases and keep different like manually split up parts of their seed phrase in different places, and it actually creates a weakness because in many cases you can actually make it very easy to brute force the seed phrase, depending on, you know, how much entropy it has. But, you know, it, like I said, it's a very complex environment. And so you can easily spend weeks or months just learning all years of the ins and outs and the best practices. And I have plenty of educational material that, you know, people are welcome to read. And this is what I do a lot of times, is I'm exploring things and then I'm writing up my learnings so that hopefully other people can save themselves some of the effort.
Is that the best place to go?
I have my blog that's also linked on there. But, you know, I've done all types of random things. Like, I've stress tested like 80 different metal backup devices for seed phrases, for example, because – as another motto we have in this space, you know, don't trust, verify. I didn't trust the claims that the manufacturers made, and I put them through the paces of heating them up to like 2,000 degrees, storing them in acid, putting them in a 20-ton hydraulic press to see how they would deform. So yeah, it's a complicated space to try to navigate, and you can certainly do so yourself if you're willing to put in the effort.
Let's talk about the numbers again. So you talked about kind of geographic dispersion of keys, etc. To what extent do you suggest? So this is again also comes towards like when you pass away and you want to bequeath your assets to somebody else. How do you think about getting other people involved where you actually have to trust other people? You know, there is like, let's say you have, you know, 3 of 5 keys or 5 of 7 keys or whatever it is, 7 of 10 or whatever it may be. There's always a risk that if they're your assets, that whoever has other keys could collude against you and to take those assets as an example. Because as you said, by definition, if you're only the one key and there, let's say, let's just make it simple, say 3 of 5. Then, you know, three of the other four could do something. So to what extent do you say, well, actually, there is a certain amount of trust that you need to have in setups. We're not in a society where you can be completely solo. Or are you advocating completely solo and then leaving information in a will somewhere? But even there, that's a single point of failure. So what are your thoughts about the trusting of other people versus not and then bequeathing your assets?
It's not necessary, but in order to guard against collusion, you have to think very deeply about game theory, and you basically have to construct a game. And I'll give you one simple, naive way. So Casa has done several iterations of our inheritance protocol. The first one was very KYC heavy and worked within the legal framework. And so, you know, what we would have our clients do, you know, this was like, you know, 4 years ago, is we would have them put one key in a safety deposit box that had beneficiaries listed on it, right? So that key won't even be accessible unless the beneficiaries come to the safety deposit box with the death certificate, so on and so forth. So that's like one way of guarding against it. We would also have their attorney hold one key. So once again, you're operating under the assumption that, you know, the attorney is going to abide by their legal duties not to collude against you. And then, of course, CASA holds one key, and we would also require a death certificate. So it's, you know, nothing is perfect, but it's all about dispersing trust as much as possible amongst a wide variety of disinterested parties, so that it's not just that you're dispersing keys amongst your own family that might collude against you if you don't fully trust them. And we ended up getting rid of that because there was just so much friction around the sort of the KYC, death certificate, attorney, aspects of it. And so what we've done is we re-architected that to instead use a couple of interesting aspects of CASA's system. Essentially, for example, if you're in a 2 of 3 setup with us and you use our new inheritance feature that we rolled out a year ago, you end up sharing an encrypted QR code, which is your mobile key on your phone, with your beneficiary. And so because that's encrypted, they can't actually do anything with it. Then the process for someone requesting to kick off the inheritance protocol is you've essentially onboarded them as a beneficiary in our app. They can't see any of your wallet data. The only thing they can do is push a button that says, I want to claim that the owner of the wallet is dead. When they do that, we start contacting you and saying, hey, your beneficiary is claiming you've passed away. If you're still alive, please let us know and we'll kick them out for being malicious. And we basically continue doing that and blasting you for 6 months. And after the 6-month time period goes uncontested, they can then decrypt that encrypted key. They can sign a transaction with one signature, and then they have to ask us to co-sign with another signature. And then, you know, the actual funds transfer process can happen. But there are essentially an infinite number of ways that you can construct the game theory around this stuff, right? And so especially if you start doing more keys, like you have 5 different keys, you have a lot more flexibility with how you can distribute them and thus create different game theory. And this is one reason why we have higher level tiers at Casa. The more expensive tiers at Casa, they're not really expensive because you get more keys. They're more expensive because you're paying for more hands-on consultation, where, you know, we're helping people create more customized architectures that essentially suit their setup, because, you know, nobody has the same life, right? Everybody has different sets of friends, family, semi-trusted individuals that they may be willing to, you know, pull in to an inheritance setup.
One question that you may or may not want to answer on air, but it's about, we obviously are a centralized crypto exchange. We have to KYC our customers for regulatory reasons. Mm-hmm. Do you ever KYC yourself on a centralized exchange? Because we talked about not doing OTC, and like, if you do that, I would imagine you're very worried, obviously, about having your data there. So, what are your responses to that?
Yeah, no, I have to KYC myself for a number of things. I'm an officer of a company, and that comes with a number of legal responsibilities. B, I have all types of different investments in private equity that has, you know, similar types of AML KYC. Yeah. I have accounts at a number of centralized exchanges. Now, this is one of the most difficult aspects of extreme privacy, and a lot of it really ties down to what I tell people is the most difficult thing of trying to be fully private. In my experience, is the DMV. It's like your driver's license. And they require a very high level of documentation and proof of, like, this is your residence. And so this is the most expensive ongoing thing that I have to do, is, like, I have to actually rent a real, you know, separate residence that can meet all of those requirements. And I just don't spend time there. So, like, that's the kind of, like, misdirection target that if my KYC data got leaked, this is why I'm still able to sleep at night, is because I'm not giving people the address of where I actually sleep at night.
Absolutely. And you have to make sure that you never give that particular address of where you actually are, right? So,
yeah.
So that's one little slip up. If you do give it away, then that kind of compromises the whole setup. So, okay, wonderful. Side question. I see all behind you Bitcoin, and you know, there's obviously tons of altcoins. Are you a Bitcoin only type of a person? Do you think there's space for others? I know Casa does more than just Bitcoin. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I've been canceled more times than I can count because I dare to be interested in non-Bitcoin things. Now, first of all, I never tell anyone what they should invest in. I generally don't even tell people that they should invest in Bitcoin. My favorite quip about that actually is, like, when people say, you know, should I buy Bitcoin? My answer is, like, if you have to ask, then the answer is no. You clearly have not researched it enough. Like, you need to keep researching it until you're convinced yourself, and you don't have to ask me or anyone else to make you feel better about whether or not you should jump in. But, you know, I'm a technologist, and so I was dabbling in altcoins back in, like, 2012, 2013. I thought Ethereum was interesting in the early days. I didn't spend a ton of time doing stuff with it because I was mostly busy building Bitcoin infrastructure. I did end up building some Ethereum and Ripple and Litecoin and Bitcoin Gold infrastructure in those like 2016, 2017 years when the altcoin boom was happening. But I also think that Bitcoin can't do everything for everyone, and this is a free market. I think it's pretty obvious that, you know, even though Bitcoin is king, I'm a cypherpunk, and I'm the first to admit that Bitcoin has terrible privacy. So I've always been interested in privacy projects from Monero to Zcash to Grin, and you know, there are plenty of what I call the Bitcoin Puritans who get very upset about me daring to mention any of those other things. I think that they're generally just afraid, like, the other things are competing with Bitcoin, and it's not good to look at competitors. But it's my innate curiosity that brought me to Bitcoin in the first place. So I have no intention of ceasing to be curious and dabbling around with other stuff. But I'm not a trader. I'm not like trying to get in early on the next altcoin and ride it up and then dump it and so on and so forth. And there are people who do that, and good luck to them. I'm not really into speculative gambling and stuff. Like, I was in Vegas for the first time 2 weeks ago, and I didn't bet a single dime on anything. It doesn't capture my attention. I prefer to play games that are more novel. And I prefer, if I'm going to gamble, I prefer to do so by investing in like seed stage startups that I feel are trying to solve a problem that no one has tried to do before.
Absolutely. I'm going to go, and we've got a few minutes left, but I want to talk to you a little bit more about the broader Bitcoin ecosystem. But before we leave kind of privacy and security, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you'd like to get the message out to the listeners about, any last tips or advice about Bitcoin, about security and privacy?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I'm kind of disillusioned about lately is that it just seems like the narrative has shifted over the past few years, and it's all like number go up, everybody is going to get rich. Don't worry about your security or your sovereignty, because, you know, your coins will increase in value even if you're leaving them with a trusted third party, or just buy the ETF, yada, yada, yada. And as a result of that, it's actually bad for Bitcoin for a number of reasons. We're seeing like more and more coins essentially getting hoovered up by a small number of institutions and other entities, and that creates systemic risk within the ecosystem. You could call it 6102 type attack risk, but basically, whenever there's a small number of entities that could be targeted by whatever, and they have a massive stash amongst them, you know, bad things can happen. It's also bad for Bitcoin from a long-term sustainability standpoint, because there's basically no fees. The miners are not earning much revenue right now outside of the block subsidy, which of course gets cut in half every 4 years. So that's a sort of an open-ended long-term question. Thankfully, the Bitcoin price tends to more than double every 4 years. But if we get to the point where it stops doing that, then we're really going to have a lot of hard questions that we need to answer if the fees are not supplanting that subsidy. So the short version of all of that is that this is another reason why you should do self-custody. It decreases the systemic risk. It's good for you personally. It gives you a stronger security model. And it's good for the thermodynamic security of the system, because you're actually creating demand for block space.
Yeah, I think that's an important point for listeners to understand, is that like, if you're buying an ETF and you know it's the safer way to buy the ETF, you got to understand that whoever the ETF provider is, they're holding, or they should be holding, the underlying crypto in some safe custody somewhere. They're going to be using a custodian, either they have their own in-house custodian or they're using an external custodian. And those custodians also have risks associated with them. So don't for a moment think that by holding the ETF alone that you've kind of abdicated responsibility and it's okay because there's zero risk. There is certainly risk. And in fact, there is potentially increased risk because as the pot gets bigger and bigger, it's a bigger kind of reward for an attacker to get. So please always remember.
Almost all of the ETFs are using Coinbase as their custodian.
That's right. So Coinbase is actually a big point of failure if something were to happen with Coinbase. Obviously, I think they take that very seriously and they do a lot in that space. But there is, again, I'm going to reiterate this. There is no situation of zero risk, right? That just doesn't exist. With Coinbase, it doesn't exist. With Valor, it doesn't exist. With yourself, it doesn't exist. We can always try to get as close as we can to 100% security. But 100% security doesn't exist anywhere. So just keep that in mind.
Yeah. Actually, I can tell you how to make your Bitcoin 100% secure. You send it to a burn address.
That's
how no one will be able to access that Bitcoin. It's perfectly secure.
Not even yourself. Exactly. all right. I was going to ask you actually about existential risks to Bitcoin. So let's fast forward to a world where Bitcoin has failed, right? And, you know, I've spent a big chunk of my career now also in this space, particularly because of Bitcoin. You've done the same. In what scenario does Bitcoin fail? Where do you see the existential risk actually coming from?
So there's a number of potential failure scenarios, and like one that's becoming more popular that we're talking about lately is quantum computing. This is a very vague and hand-wavy problem because it's almost impossible to pinpoint and quantify what the current level of risk is and to put a measurable time frame on how long we have. The estimates of how long we have before a quantum attacker can actually reverse engineer Bitcoin private keys is anywhere from today to never. It's a very wide range of opinions around the risk there. But there are various government agencies and standards institutes that are basically saying we all need to move to post-quantum cryptography in the next 5, 6, 7 years. So that's one data point. We can also see that there are massive advancements happening by a variety of different companies that are working on improving the hardware and the software for quantum computing. And so while I can't stand here and say we only have X number of years, what I can say and what I've been talking about is that we can work backwards from whatever this Q day might be and say, how long do we need as an ecosystem in order to upgrade and mitigate this attack? And I think like minimum 5 years. You need generally several years to actually debate a proposal before it can go in. And then it can still take several years after that to activate. And then it will take several years for the rest of the ecosystem to adopt and write the software and get it into all of the wallets. And then it will take years for people to actually migrate all of their Bitcoin to new unspent transaction outputs that would have whatever the quantum safe cryptography securing them is. And so I worry about that not so much because I know when quantum is going to break Bitcoin, but because I know how slow and how hard it is to upgrade Bitcoin. And kind of along a similar vein, something that I've been talking about for many years is just ossification in general. And basically what that means is that this is a well understood aspect of network protocols that as the size of the network grows, this is an anarchic system, right? We're deploying rules, but there are no rulers that are authorities that dictate what the rules are. So changing the rules actually becomes harder and harder as the size of the network grows because you can't coordinate amongst the larger and larger, more diverse set of participants. And eventually, like the ability to change a protocol, to change the rules, kind of collapses under the weight of the size of the network. It can no longer move in any direction. That's why like ossification is is really means like the calcification, like turning into bone. You can no longer move. And so I worry about that, specifically related to quantum computing, but even more generally just related to upgrading and evolving Bitcoin as a system. And so I have a number of talks that I've given where I actually talk about other internet-based protocols and ways where their ossification actually many years down the line created problems and weaknesses. And the general reason for that is that you can freeze or ossify a protocol, but you cannot freeze or ossify the rest of the world. And so eventually what happens is new threats, new types of attacks come into existence. And if the protocol cannot evolve to meet and mitigate those attacks, then you end up with really hacky solutions. One of my favorite examples is actually SMTP, which is the email protocol. I was an email engineer for 10 years before I got into Bitcoin stuff. And so I saw this happening firsthand. Essentially, SMTP ossify like in the 1990s. But then as millions of people started coming online, a bunch of people started abusing the protocol to send spam because it was so much cheaper than snail mail, we ended up with massive problems where SMTP as a protocol was developed in the 1970s under the assumption that every user would want to receive all the messages. So it was basically designed to nearly guarantee delivery of messages. So now what happens, 20, 25 years later is this gets flipped on its head where we actually have this protocol that's great for guaranteeing message delivery, but now we want to not guarantee message delivery. And so we then spent several decades slapping all of these hacky solutions for spam mitigation onto the email protocol. And they all ended up being highly centralized. And basically ended up being like reputation based and created a bunch of gatekeepers. And so now where we are is that you ask somebody, is email popular? And they'll say, oh yeah, billions of people use email. But I would argue to you that actually almost nobody uses SMTP. Almost nobody runs their own email server anymore because it's simply not economically feasible to do so. It's a really, really high cost in order to maintain all of these meta protocols and maintain your reputation amongst all of the gatekeepers. That's essentially what we were doing when I was at this email marketing company, is we were hiring dozens of people to manage our reputation with the ISPs and the blacklist providers and so on. And so while you can technically download the software and run an email server today, it's almost guaranteed that, within a few weeks or months, you're going to get blacklisted and your ability to use email as a sovereign email user is dead. It's just, it's not feasible. And so point being, it is not hard at all for me to envision a similar type of situation happening with Bitcoin. We're already seeing more centralization happening amongst a variety of different vectors, whether it's the custodians or the miners or what have you. And so all of those things are concerning. And I figure like if Bitcoin cannot evolve to be able to react to new stresses, then we may not like the ultimate end situation for what Bitcoin ends up being.
So given that you said quantum basically attacks concerns, and then also this ossification that you've just talked about, I assume you're still long Bitcoin and you think that the reality of that actually emerging isn't too close.
So that's another funny thing, is that much like how email became super popular, even as I argue the sovereignty inherent to email as a system was crushed over the decades, I also believe that it's entirely possible that Bitcoin's exchange rate continues to rise exponentially, even as some of the fundamental properties of Bitcoin continue to get degraded. That's one of the scariest things to me, is that the incentives might not be aligned there. Like, if this is a very common thing that we hear from the pro-ossification camp is, oh, Bitcoin's doing great, we're all getting rich, don't mess with something that ain't broke, right? Don't try to fix it. And I think that that is a very naive way of going about looking at this, is like, the price of Bitcoin should not be our like main metric or indicator of the health of Bitcoin as a network.
I think that's very wise. We are nearly on the hour. Do you have a couple more minutes after that, or have you got a hard stop?
Yeah, just a few.
Okay, so one just larger question, and then I'll just start wrapping up. If you look at the analog, let's say analog version of Bitcoin, if you want to think about gold, okay, and you see that in the 1930s, the U.S. government basically forbade the public from owning any gold, right? Do you see similar threats in the future when it comes to kind of nation states and their relationship with Bitcoin? What are your concerns, particularly from security and a privacy perspective, when you think about such a scenario? Do you think, don't worry about that, or is that something that also concerns you?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully we're in a decent scenario, at least for the next few years. But actually, one thing I've said is that it's somewhat concerning to see nation states getting more interested in Bitcoin, because, you know, one of the scariest things out there is the line, you know, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. A lot of terrible things have resulted from that line of thinking. And that could also play into this ossification stuff, right? It's like, if the United States decides that this like strategic Bitcoin reserve is incredibly important to them, they might start doing and taking actions around, you know, people trying to improve Bitcoin if they disagree with some of those proposed changes. It's also tough because, you know, pretty much all of us have KYC'd, I think, and so we're all on lists somewhere. You know, to put a different point on it, my grandfather actually showed me photos from his childhood where they had gold bars. They had actually like prospected and found gold, you know, in creeks near where they lived. And when the 6102 executive order happened, they didn't follow it. They just held on to it. They didn't tell anybody about it. And you know, eventually that it got dropped. But, you know, they were safe because there was no database with their name on it saying that they owned gold. So they were able to just, you know, hide it under the mattress type of thing. It's a lot trickier, I think, for most of us in this space today.
Absolutely. Well, Jameson, where can people find you? And we talked about lop.net. Where else can they find you? Or what's a good way to get in touch with you if people can get in touch with you?
Yeah, I have a contact page on my website there, and you know, I'm pretty active on X. My handle is just LOPP.
Awesome. And any last comments before we close of questions that I should have asked that I didn't, or anything that you want to share with our listeners?
Well, I mean, security can be very, very overwhelming. Similar thing with privacy, right? And I'm on the extreme end of both, but I've also been doing it for over a decade. But you don't have to go from 0 to 100, right? You can do incremental steps. You can greatly improve your privacy in one weekend just by installing various ad blockers and VPNs and privacy software, you know, on your computer. And you can keep building upon that. Same thing with security. You can take your time, you know, don't rush into anything. And as long as you keep moving forward and keep educating yourself, then, you know, eventually all of those gains will compound upon each other.
Awesome. Jameson, fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for your time, and stay well.
Thanks for having me.